25 years ago, a new device changed the way we listen to music. As light and portable as a transistor radio, the Sony Walkman allowed us to pop in cassette tapes and take the soundtrack of our lives almost anywhere. Even at the outrageous price of $199.99, it was a huge success. Stores scrambled to keep up with demand. A few years later, of course, it was the Discman, and then the Minidisc, and now the Apple iPod is all the rage. This latest gadget lets you put 10,000 songs in a container the size of a pack of cigarettes and makes that once wondrous Walkman seem like something from the Stone Age. In his new book, journalist Mark Coleman says the all-conquering computer also represents a decisive change in the music business. A century after technology created the music industry, digital devices have all but killed the album and the home stereo system, mortally wounded the compact disc, and fundamentally changed pop culture. Later in the program, we'll look at another digital technology, the camera phone, which is raising privacy issues almost unimaginable only a couple of years ago. But first, how technology shapes music and culture. What music format did you start with? 78s, 45s, 8 tracks? Did you change formats with the times, or do you still have that wax cylinder collection? Give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Mark Coleman joins us now from the studios of NPR West. His new book is Playback, From the Victrola to the MP3, 100 Years of Music, Machines, and Money. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. It's good to be here.
Now, it seems obvious when we think about it, but you point out the music industry did not really exist until the technology developed to mass market records.
Yes, music existed in the public sphere or at home if someone could play the piano. But it really wasn't until the invention of recording that it existed as an object that could be marketed.
Now, Edison was the father of a recorded sound, but also the grandfather of the music industry?
Well, yes, but when he invented the phonograph, he thought he was inventing an office dictation machine, and it wasn't until Emil Berliner, about 10 years later, invented the gramophone, which was really the first turntable with a disc. Edison's original phonograph was played a cylinder, a device like a tin can that spun laterally.
And you point out that immediately thereafter, we had some developments that turned into patterns throughout the last century of recorded sound. First, that there were hardware issues, what you call format wars.
Yes, and the first one would have been the battle between discs and cylinder. You had the Victrola Company, which was formed early in the 20th century, which marketed the Victrola, and that was really the first mass market phonograph, and it caught on big time. And Edison was making cylinder phonographs at the same time, and they actually sounded better than the early disc phonographs, but the disc phonographs of Victrola were much easier to use and a little cheaper, so they really caught on.
And one of the things that really happened to make them catch on was the first true music superstar, Enrico Caruso. And let's hear a little bit of what captivated the world and certainly America. Here he is performing O Sole Mio. So, Mark Coleman, what was it that made Enrico Caruso the first true superstar?
His voice was uniquely suited for the early recording process. That early records were made using a horn rather than a microphone, and his voice, a tenor, fit the dimensions of the horn perfectly. In fact, his voice was so powerful he had to stand 6 feet away from it when he was recording, and he also, and I think we can hear this today, he projected a real charisma and warmth in his singing. And his 3 and 4 minute arias, the early records, really caught on in the way that pop records would later.
And because he had a commitment to the company that made discs as opposed to cylinders, that certainly helped the gramophone take off.
Yes, though actually he recorded for Edison also. In those days, artists wouldn't exclusively record for one company, so they would record a song for six or seven companies at the same time.
Now, the other thing that the pattern that certainly emerged very early was all kinds of popular music. We hear about Caruso and the classical music, the high end, if you will, but there was all kinds of popular music that indeed sold a lot more.
Right from the very beginning, and it was a lot of so-called ethnic records. So you'd have the early ragtime and then jazz records, but also Yiddish folk songs and spoken routines, Irish music, German songs, really from every immigrant group that was in America. But, you know, consistently through history, it's been black American music that's been at the cutting edge of technology.
And there were also very early on white covers of black ethnic music.
Right from the very beginning. Of course, in the early days, in the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation, it was the so-called blackface or minstrel music, which seems, you know, woefully racist and disrespectful to us today. But I think it shows at that time a real fascination with black, if we can get past, you know, the sort of racist look of it, you know, it showed there was a real fascination with black culture on the part of white people right from the beginning.
And one of the things you argue that is that this music, available to anybody who walked into a record store, really began to break down a lot of class and race barriers. There was the crossover phenomenon.
I think the phonograph was really an engine of integration before the civil rights movement. And the first record that featured black musicians playing the blues was a song called Crazy Blues by Mamie Smith in 1920. And that was also the first crossover record that reached a white audience and became a huge seller.
Now, the next technological change was really the introduction of a new medium, radio.
Yes, and that radio started to catch on in the 20s, and the sound quality was much better, and now at this time, live music was played on the radio and not records, and there was quite a controversy came up after that once records started to be played on the radio.
Mm-hmm. And there was a new style of singing as well, a medium adapted not so well to the belters like Caruso and his ilk, but to a crooner. Let's hear a little bit of Bing Crosby.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Shows no.
Now that's a voice that can barely be heard without a microphone and an amplifier.
Yes, in the mid-20s, with the advent of electrical recording, microphones started to be used, so the sound waves were translated into electrical waves and recorded on the record that way rather than directly, you know, cutting into the wax the way the early records and cylinders were made. So, yes, it enabled a lot of different voices, you know, people like Bing Crosby and Rudy Valley, to come across a lot better on record than they would have previously.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, one of the things you also point out is that once you had radio and records available across the country, there was a new professional standard for music. Suddenly that marching band that got together every July the 4th to march downtown, suddenly didn't sound so great anymore.
Yeah, people were able to hear the people who were at the very top of their field performing. And, you know, in the 19th century, that wasn't true when there was the great opera singer Jenny Lind, who H.P. Barnum brought over. You know, if you were lucky enough to be in town when she played a concert, you got to hear that. But otherwise, you know, you were just used to your local singer. So it really made a whole range of things available to people.
Now, one thing that we've not been talking about, we've been talking about various kinds of formats, and obviously because the records were only so many minutes long, they had to shape the music in that way, and it various media adapted to various musical styles. But the third element in your title has been a significant factor from the very beginning, and that's money.
Yeah, so the business really grew out of the technology.
In what sense?
Well, there wasn't something to sell before there were records.
Right. Other than a live performance, come to the opera and see this particular performer. So that once there were records, suddenly you started to have talent scouts and superstars.
Yes. And a whole structure grew up around that. A record company had to distribute and manufacture records as well as record them and promote them. So you had a huge business grew up.
And, of course, the radio business spawned the television business, and it's all been downhill ever since. But anyway, if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Mark Coleman, the author of a new book called Playback, From the Victrola to the MP3, 100 Years of Music, Machines, and Money. Let's get some listeners on the line. Karen joins us from Tucson, Arizona.
That's right. Hi, we used to have a used record store in the new wave punk era, and we were also Beatles collectors, so we still have a few thousand vinyl records sitting in our front room, and we don't even have a turntable set up anymore. I mean, we've got colored vinyl and imports and bootlegs and, you know, lots and lots of stuff, and my husband is busy putting lots of things on MP3s to listen to his iPod, and he feels as long as you have the material in some form you can listen to, it doesn't really matter that whether you have all this music in other forms. And I feel that, you know, having spent all that time and effort into collecting all those records, you don't want to just throw them away. So I wonder if you guys have any insights into that.
Well, Mark?
That's the horns of a dilemma a lot of people are on, because there's a lot of records. Records take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have records and CDs and things stored, and they don't know whether to get rid of them. I mean, do you see any interest anymore in those records? I mean, do you think you could sell them? Or you don't even want to, I guess.
Well, I don't even want to, but even if I did, I mean, what are you going to do? Put 3,000 records on eBay, 10 at a time, and
yeah,
it's even going to be worth your while to do.
I've got 2,000 records sitting in storage, so I'm with you. But I sympathize with your husband. I mean, the bottom line is I like listening to stuff, so I try to adapt to each new format as it comes along, and you don't have much choice. And I think the advantage of digital music now, music on the computer, is that it gives you some flexibility. You can listen to it on your computer, you can load it into a player like the iPod, or you can burn a CD and listen to it. So you kind of get the best of both worlds that way.
Well, I thought you said something very provocative in your book, Mark Coleman, and that is, in the digital age, no single style or sound can dominate and define pop music as it once did. Indeed, the logical conclusion of this digital age, digital adage, troubles most middle-aged rockers. While perhaps hard to accept, pop music is no longer the cultural focus of adolescent and young adulthood, an emerging person's picture window on the world, just one choice amongst many.
Well, I say that, write that as a middle-aged rocker myself, so I'm not trying to be condescending or anything. I think if you look at the home computer, it can do a lot more than just play music. That's just one function of it, and it's not to say that young people aren't any more passionate, any less passionate about music than they've ever been. It's simply that they are overwhelmed with many, many more choices, so it's just they have to strike a different balance with it.
And they're not going to go out and buy an album of anything. They might pick one tune or another.
Exactly. And I think the driving force behind the popularity of internet on the music, or one of the driving forces, has been the vast selection that's there. There's so much music out there now in so many different styles and sub-styles, and it's a lot easier on the computer, whether you're doing it legally or illegally, to access a lot of different styles. You kind of eliminate the gatekeepers sometimes.
Well, Karen, good luck, and I hope you get some 2x4s in your basement to prop up all the weight of all those vinyl in your front room.
Or something.
Thanks.
I do want to just inject a little bit.
Very quickly.
We do listen to lots of different musical styles now that probably would not have been true in earlier eras.
Thanks for the phone call, Karen.
Thanks.
We'll be back with more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with journalist Mark Coleman about how technology shapes music, how music shapes technology, and how technology drives the business. His new book is called Playback from the Victrola to the MP3, 100 Years of Music Machines and Money. We'd like to hear from you as well, whatever format you listen to. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. And we have an email from Richard Look. How can you say that Edison or Berliner invented the modern music industry? What about piano rolls, he asks? Music boxes with changeable discs, the sale and marketing of sheet music?
The sale and marketing of sheet music existed before the invention of the record, that's true. But it was a much smaller phenomenon than the music business. You know, there weren't many people, you know, I don't have a number on hand, but, you know, there weren't that many pianos in people's homes. So, yeah, perhaps it's incorrect. The music business as we know it today, I think, began with the invention of the record.
Okay. Let's get another caller in. John is with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay.
Great, great. Yeah, I still have my 8 tracks, my 45s, my 78s. I got over 1,000 LPs, and I sympathize with that lady in Tucson.
Me too.
Me there's three. A place in Tucson called Bookman's if she ever decides to go ahead and get rid of those records.
But for a fraction of the psychic cost that her husband expended purchasing them in the first place.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I couldn't tell you how many thousands of dollars I got in it. Actually, I went on a flea market up here in Phoenix about 2 years ago and picked up about 150 Bing Crosby 78s, and some of them are in excellent condition.
And what do you listen to them on?
I have a 78 turntable. Yeah, they're still available. You can still find them on the Internet. I've got two turntables, one that just plays my 78s, and I have another one that does play all the rest of them. And I have two 8-track decks, and I still can record and make 8-tracks.
Do they sound just as wonderful as they did back in the day? I mean, to get the full effect, you got to be moving that car pretty good to get that...
Yeah, absolutely. But I love my music. I just do love it, yes.
Thanks very much, John.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
You too. He points out we've skipped several decades into the future to 8-tracks, but I mean, there have always been these miracle formats that come out to try to find a niche and either succeed, and some of them, like the 8-track, consigned to the dustbin of history.
That's true, but you know, the 8-track at its peak in 1975 accounted for 25% of recorded music sales, which just strikes me as incredible right now. And now, I was a teenager then, cruising around in an old Cutlass with my friend and listening to the Allman Brothers and Mott the Hoople and such ancient things on an 8-track. You know, so they really were popular. And as you point out, it was in the automobile where they kind of made sense. But they seem so clunky and bad-sounding now, it's hard to imagine they were that popular. And, you know, 3 or 4 years after that, they completely disappeared. So it was a brief phenomenon.
We have an email from Jay Cady. I want to stick up for the much maligned 8-track tape. When my best friend in high school got an 8-track deck in his car, it was the cause for celebration. We were no longer subject to the whims of the radio or parent-imposed volume limits of the home stereo. Plus, it divided an album into 4 sections so you could overplay your favorites and skip the clunkers. 8-tracks were soon surpassed technologically, but we had some great times with it. So I guess it's fondly remembered. Of course, the rise of new formats of recorded music means old formats eventually die out. It's hard enough to find a new turntable these days, let alone a Victrola. So what does that mean when you have a collection of 8-tracks or your parents' collection of 78s? Steve Smolian helps breathe life into those old collections. He operates Smolian Sound Studios in Frederick, Maryland, where he specializes in preserving sound from obsolete media. And he joins us now by phone from his studios. And welcome back to Talk the Nation, Steve.
Thank you, Neil.
So what's the process for putting an old recording onto a new format?
Mostly it consists of restoring the old format so it doesn't destroy the original, and making sure that it doesn't add unwelcome noises to the signal when it gets transferred to a new medium.
So that means that at your studio you must have a collection of virtually every kind of recorded sound medium there ever was.
Well, I choose to think so, but I'm sure there'll be more that people will write into you about or call into you about, but there's a lot of stuff here.
For example?
Well, I have something called a record graph, which embossed 35-millimeter clear film on an endless loop of about 50 feet. And it's sprocketed, and was used for the recording the D-Day pool.
The D-Day pool.
Yes, but Mr. George Hicks was the pool designated reporter, and he recorded on a machine similar to this. It faded probably by about 1947 or so, but they tried marketing it for home use, and I have one of those around.
Do people still bring to you, you know, old Edison cylinders, a Cohen on the telephone, that sort of thing?
Yes, but be careful, this is the radio. I could recite it by heart.
I haven't heard it in a while, but it's not bad. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, well, they do bring me cylinders and home recording discs of various types, and particularly those that come from old dictating machines, for which it's really hard to find.
The dictabelts and various kinds of things.
Not only dictabelts, but also some of the little clear plastic or colored plastic discs, very thin, that play at weird speeds, and you need the right machine to play them back on so that they come out uniformly in pitch from one end to the other. But I must say they're usually not very good for recording music anyway. Not just limited frequency, but a lot of wow and flutter and unsteady tone.
Wow, a good quality in most categories, in recorded music, a very poor quality.
Yes, it's a wow without an exclamation point.
Let's get a caller on the line. Bill joins us on the line from Sacramento.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
It was interesting to hear about the recording of Caruso. My grandfather was actually the person who recorded Caruso first.
Really?
Yeah, he was the chairman of the board of the Victor Talking Machine Company. And they gave those records away, and people needed the machines to buy to play the records, and hence it was a big promotional thing that I'm told that they did to get their Victor Talking Machines on the market.
So it was a lost leader. You give it away, and then, well, you know, you're going to have to buy this big piece of furniture to play it.
Well, yeah, and or a tabletop version. There were all kinds of them, but they were also one of the first. They also made them look like furniture instead of like Edison's machine, which stood on the tabletop and was kind of obtrusive, if you will. He was an inventor, actually, and he invented a double-tracking needle that made Edison's phonograph louder. His name was Leon Forrest Douglas. And he lived in Menlo Park, California, and Edison lived in Menlo Park, New Jersey.
I was going to say the wizard of the other Menlo Park.
Well, I always thought they were talking about my grandmother, my grandfather, when they were talking about the wizard of Menlo Park, until I grew up and learned that more about Edison. But the Victrola was actually named after my grandmother, Victoria.
Really?
And they eventually sold the company to Radio Corporation of America, and the logo of Nipper listening to his master's voice, which actually happened, by the way. The dog actually did jump up on a workbench and heard the recording of his master, and then eventually that became the logo for the company.
You'll be interested to know that Nipper has been always adopted as sort of the informal mascot of NPR, National Public Radio.
Wow, that's great.
We have a large model of the dog from the label sitting downstairs in the lobby, often dressed in seasonal garb.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying Nipper, and Nipper is enjoying an ongoing life.
Do you have, by the way, after all of that, do you have Caruso recordings in your home today, Bill?
No, I wish I did. One of my cousins has a picture of Caruso recording into those horns that your first guest was talking about. They would record, I think, four or six records at a time. Well, was the way they had to do it.
And they couldn't. They didn't make a master recording and then subsequent pressings. It was a different technology.
Not at first.
Yeah.
Not at first.
It's interesting, Mark Coleman, in your book, you tell the story. It's Bill was talking about how various kinds of devices to make things louder, there was very difficult ways to regulate sound, the volume of sound, including one device that I didn't realize where this expression came from. Would you elucidate, please?
There were no volume controls on the early phonographs, so there was a sock that you could put in the speaker horn, hence put a sock in it. And some of the players also came with doors that would close over the speakers to muffle the sound.
Bill, thanks very much, and thanks posthumously to your grandfather.
Okay. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
If I can come in here for a moment.
Go ahead, Steve
Smalley. In again.
Yeah.
This is a family legend, but it's not quite accurate.
Ah.
I just heard.
The naming of the record,
well, the
Victrola?
That's been fairly well identified as not being accurate, though there's a letter in the Victor files that refers to this event. It's been worked back so that this turns out to have been history made afterwards. But Caruso's first records were also not made at Victor. They were made at the Gramophone Company in England, actually in Italy, by a Gramophone Company England executive who was traveling with a portable system. Leon Douglas probably did record or was active in the recording of the first Caruso records in the U.S.
Here's an email question that we have from Nate Angel, I guess it's pronounced. It seems to me vibrato was once common in vocal music but has gradually almost disappeared from popular singing. Is there a relationship between technical developments in microphones, etc., and the disappearance of vibrato? Mark Coleman, was this something you explored?
Not really. I would think that's a question of changing tastes. You know, certainly the equipment now is capable of reproducing any sound in a much wider range than compared to these limited machines. So that's more an aesthetic thing, I would guess.
Well, there's another angle to this, and that is that in the early days with the acoustic recording, you had to sing pretty much from the gut the way an opera singer does, even if you were a popular singer. Later on, with a microphone, you could amplify what was coming in, and you had the crooners develop.
Steve Smalley, before we let you go, I wonder, you make a business of taking old formats, old media, and putting them on modern media. Does anybody come to you and say, can you put my my brand new tunes by Beyonce or something on a cylinder? Does everybody go in the other direction?
Well, I just saw something on one of my listservs of somebody who makes cylinders to be used on Edison and Columbia players using more modern music than when the cylinders ceased being manufactured, and he's got an Elvis record listed there. So if you want to hear Elvis downdated, so to speak, and there's your opportunity. I don't get calls for that much, but of course the DJs are making discs, lacquer discs, so they can manipulate them, and they're making them from CDs when there's no commercial one available. They have studios that do that for them.
Okay, Steve Smalley, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Steve Smalley is a recording engineer. He specializes in preserving sound from outdated media. He was with us from his studio in Frederick, Maryland. For a link to Steve's studio, you can go to www.npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And as we continue to explore this, the way that technology shaped music and culture, Mark Coleman, well, there's one particular personality in music, a musician, a guitar maker, sound engineer, and the pioneer of multi-track recording. Now, this is a little bit of Les Paul with Mary Ford.
Somewhere there's music, I'll paint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high in the moon. There is no moon above, love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me, it's out of use. Where there's music, I'll dare how far.
Now, Mark, there was only one Mary Ford. She wasn't one of triplets. Les Paul figured out how to make that sound.
Yes, after World War II, a lot of new technology was introduced, including tape recording, and that made it possible to stack tracks, to do multiple takes, and then kind of assemble the sounds together onto one record, rather than having one group playing live all at once and cutting that directly to the record. So and Les Paul did this tinkering in his garage over a number of years.
And there's almost a direct line between that version of How High the Moon and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Indeed.
And the curiosity was Les Paul went on to invent the first 8-track tape recorder and made the first of those commercially available. He used the first one himself, but the second one went to Atlantic Records and was used first, I think, to record a Splish Splash by Bobby Darin. Now, there's a piece of artistry that will never die.
Yes.
The turntable, writes Aaron in St. Paul, is hardly obsolete. The advent of DJ culture among young people has allowed turntables to outsell guitars in some markets. Although the technology for CD DJ equipment is becoming better, most young DJs shirk the uncoolness of this phenomenon. I spend upwards of $50 to $75 per week on vinyl. Now, you write in your book that the word, the expression DJ has gone through at least, what, 4 iterations now?
Yeah, well, it began as the people who spun records on the air and then went on to the club scene, where first with disco and then hip-hop, DJs really became innovative in their use of records and using 2 turntables. And the disco DJs really perfected the art of the segue and kind of stimulating and responding to the crowd's tastes. And then the hip-hop DJs were really technological innovators, and they took bits of different records and pieced them together into something new. And hip-hop really began as a DJ's art, and the rapping came later. You know, that the then MCs would improvise rhymes and lyrics over the DJ's music.
And I think you'll hear this evening on All Things Considered a story that scratching, as it's known, is now going to be taught at the Berklee School of Music in Boston, a pretty prestigious prestigious school.
Come a long way from being invented on the streets of the South Bronx.
Just before we let you go, as you look ahead to the future of the business, are musicians right? Is the advent of the computer going to kill the music business?
Not at all. I think it's going to force the business to restructure the way it is now. And, you know, I think you'll see people... It may kill the pre-recorded CD. I think that's going to fade away, and people will record their own CDs and listen to music on players and computers, but I think people want that flexibility and also the portability that we were talking about before with the iPod.
And it's going to be a brand new world. Mark Coleman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much. It was fun.
Mark Coleman, the author of Playback, From the Victrola to MP3, 100 Years of Music, Machines, and Money. He joined us from the studios of NPR West. When we come back from our break, another example of technology changing culture. Be careful what you do in front of that phone. It could be a camera. If you own one of these newfangled camera phones, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. How do you decide what pictures to take and what pictures not to take, and who to tell about what you've got pictures of? I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.